The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Fresh tiger feces are normally accompanied by urine sprays that smell like well-cooked basmati rice.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. We've got so much to squeeze into this week's podcast.
They seem to be quite up for sex, but just in this 12-hour window.
We delve into the world of China's political furball.
And then have ferocious sex.
First a book on a giant tortoise, now a book on a giant panda.
There's this mythical, intangible panda out there that I think is quite important. I don't think it's quite as cuddly as the zoo one.
And a mention for big cat droppings.
Tiger feces are the size of a large beetroot and have a characteristic pungent musky odour.
Richard Holmes asks why women have been historically overlooked in science.
Caroline's speciality was discovering new comets, of which she found no less than 8 at a time when fewer than 30 were known.
Then this podcast takes a musical turn as we visit the UK's largest private solar power plant. And it's not where you'd expect.
The farms are very sort of energised by it, and so the whole festival, sustainability thing, is looking very, very good at the moment.
Plus, what does particle physics actually sound like? A bit like this. And... well, if we can't blow our own trumpets, then no one will.
People's reactions generally to physics are, oh, it's really difficult, it's really scary. What we wanted to show with the Web Wars is that there's lots of fun, interesting physics that anyone can read about or find out about.
This is the award-winning Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. In the studio today are the Guardian's Ian Sample. Ian, have you won any awards?
Plenty.
Any you can list?
Yeah.
Any real ones, I mean? Not ones that your daughter has given you for being a good dad or something.
Well, I've got a few for journalism, but they're quite easy to get.
Yeah, whatever.
But then my most proud award is for horse riding, weirdly.
You can ride a horse?
Yeah. Or this was a while ago, but I won an award when I was at uni for riding a horse.
Wow. I'm not even going to investigate that any further because I don't believe you. Also here is Henry Nichols, a science writer and expert on lonely and endangered animals. Why don't you just list your awards too? Anything to do with horses? Or
no.
I'm hoping not. No
horses. No, I was a champion ice skater.
Fantastic.
Ice dancer.
Fantastic. I'm not sure if any of this is true. Brilliant. Okay, well, also Henry's the author of two environmentally themed books. Lonesome George was his previous one. It was a story about a giant ancient tortoise on the Galapagos Islands. His new book is called The Way of the Panda. What is it about you and endangered animals?
Well, I thought the first book was a successful sort of strategy. So take a very interesting, in this case, an individual animal, this tortoise
last
George,
of
last of his kind. And he was the kind of narrative, he had a good story to him that then I could wrap lots of other stuff around. And it seemed like a really nice way to structure a book.
The start of the book is about how pandas were, in inverted commas, discovered less than 150 years ago,
right.
Discovered by the West. Where were they before that? What were they doing?
Running
away.
Were they
hiding?
They were running away. So as China expanded and people moved into the countryside, they would have cut down bamboo forests and just been moving in and encroaching on pandas'
so
territory.
Genuinely, they were running away.
They were running away, and people would really not have seen them very much. But long before you've got to them, the panda has just moved off, which is why we find them at the top of mountains. That's all that's left. It's not because that's where they were. They were all the way across China. But over the last 2,000 years, they've just been moving steadily to the most secluded places. The Chinese, it's pretty clear, knew very little about the giant panda. It doesn't appear in any of their very significant natural history books from the medieval period. No artistic renditions of it until the 20th century, which is quite remarkable for a species.
So tied in with China now. Yeah,
so visual. You know, if you saw a panda, you'd draw it, wouldn't you?
in the intervening century and a half, lots and lots of myths have sprung up about this animal. The fact they don't like sex, it seems that they're completely herbivores. All they do is eat bamboo shoots. They're maladapted to their environments. Take us through how some of this stuff came about. For example, the maladaption to the environment. A lot of people seem to think that they're some sort of evolutionary dead end. This isn't right at all.
I don't think it is right, it's a very simple fact that the panda or something like it has been around doing its thing for about 20 million years, which is about 20 million years longer than modern humans have been around, as good as. And so they must have something going for them. They are incredibly effective at eating bamboo. And I like to think of bamboo as really rather a good food source if you can find a way to eat it. It doesn't have much nutrition, and so not a lot of things end up specializing in it, particularly carnivores. But if you can find a way to do it, then it's brilliant, because it was everywhere. It grows incredibly fast, and it's green all year round. So actually, if you can find a way to eat it, you don't have to do very much. You just eat. You have to eat a lot. So that's what pandas do, and they've got lots of physical adaptations to help them, and obviously a symbiosis with some quite sophisticated gut microbes that allow them to digest the stuff. And so settling on bamboo, I like to think of as rather an incredibly shrewd
and bamboo
evolutionary
is
strategy.
Something more than 99% of their diet. Well, what is the other bit? What's the other 1%?
Well, they will scavenge off meat if they come across it. So they don't go hunting like other bears might. If they come across a dead carcass, they'll just gobble it up.
In the past few decades, another reason that people sort of might have heard of pandas, of course, is that they're endangered, and there have been lots of attempts to try and get animals in the wild in China to have sex, to try and reproduce, but they're just not interested in that, or at least so that's the myth goes.
Right, well, that's where the myth comes from. It's because humans have tried to get them to breed in captivity. The panda has a very unusual but not unreasonable reproductive strategy. It is very different from ours. So the female will become fertile once a year, probably for about 12 hours, and then have ferocious sex, probably. Well, no one really seen it very much, so they don't know. But they seem to be quite up for sex, but just in this 12-hour window. But possibly more times in that 12-hour window they will have sex than quite a lot of humans. And then the female will always get pregnant, and as far as the data shows. And so at any stage a female is fertile, she's going to have offspring. So it is quite an effective reproductive strategy in the wild. The pandas can find each other very efficiently during this fertile period, and they have no problems reproducing. So it's when you abstract that and you take them into captivity, of course, humans trying to get and coordinate this reproductive thing is very hard. You have to keep pandas separate because they'll fight outside the fertile period. So in zoos, you keep the male and the female separate, but of course you have to put them together for those 12 hours. And that's the challenge that has thwarted the zoo technicians for 30 years or so. Now we've kind of cracked it. But
we're on to panda sex. So naturally I have to ask Ian if he's got any thoughts on this. I mean, this is your specialist area, isn't it, Ian?
It's really interesting to hear this, but I'd love to know, is it obvious when this 12-hour period is arriving and when we're in it, or... how's the guy supposed to know is the kind of lay way of putting that question.
It's the ultimate question.
How's the guy panda?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pandas, yeah. The pandas have no problem working it out, and they do it all through smell. There's a series of brilliant experiments on panda olfaction in the late 90s and early 2000s that have shown an absolutely incredible sense of smell that this species has, and they're solitary for most of the year. They'll just go around by themselves just eating bamboo, but through a sort of series of scent posts that they've got dotted throughout the forest, they keep track of the location, the identity, and the sexual or the fertile status of all the other pandas that near them, and then will hook up. And humans obviously aren't tuned into those cues, and I've had to devise sort of ways to do it, and to do it through monitoring of hormones in urine to work out when the female is coming into her fertile period.
And how many are there, though? Just looking at the sheer numbers of pandas, I mean, do they warrant this this iconic image position in conservation that they have?
Very controversial, that. So to qualify as endangered on the IUCN red list, that you have to meet certain criteria. And I think it's 2,500. I'll be corrected if I got that wrong, but it's 2,500 or something like that in the wild, or fewer, and then you go on to the top notch, the level of endangeredness. And the official statistics from China on the last census suggest there are about 1,600 pandas left in the wild. But controversially, a DNA study of panda poo sort of scaled that up. So they looked at one reserve and counted the number of pandas, and it was many more than the official census. It was almost double the official census, so they reckon there might be 3,000 pandas in the wild. If that's the case, then pandas are not so endangered as we think, and that would be very controversial and very political.
What's the prognosis for the panda then now? Is the future optimistic for them?
Well, in my book, I've tied the future of the panda to the future of China as a nation. So I think whilst China remains strong, it is going to plough everything into its national symbol. So I feel quite positive about the future of the panda, at least for the next century or so. But it doesn't mean that things could not be improved. And there's certainly the way that the panda is taken into captivity, and that the captive panda has become really very, very significant, I think is quite a distraction from the real conservation effort of wild pandas. I kind of argue that the captive panda isn't really a panda, it's a deception. So when you see a captive panda, you're not really seeing a panda, you're seeing this human abstraction of it, this cute, cuddly thing that isn't really representative of the wild animal. And if that is what you focus on as pandas, that's probably what you end up conserving, not the real wild thing.
Okay, well, look, we can't finish talking to you without getting an update on Lonesome George, this again, a sort of another slightly mythologized animal. What's happening with Lonesome George? Last time we spoke about it, he was possibly going to become a dad. Now, did that happen?
It didn't happen. So he is the last of his kind. So it's quite difficult.
There's some effort to try and
to imagine how he. Yeah. But he's been housed now for it's 20 years now, with two females from a different island.
And still hasn't managed to get it on.
Well, so they can hybridize these tortoises, and the hope was that he would. Over the last couple of years, the females have laid clutches of eggs that have caused some excitement in Galapagos and then around the world. No one had actually observed George mating, and tortoises, like chickens, will lay eggs without having mated. And pretty much this is certainly what happened here, that the eggs were not fertile.
But they're still trying, right?
They're not trying with George, the tortoises, or the people there.
I don't know, the whole complex of people and tortoise. They're trying to get him to reproduce.
They've got sort of more important things, possibly, in Galapagos, more pressing things than these tortoises. So they let them get on with it, which obviously isn't working quite. What can they do, Alok?
I don't know. I'm no endangered animal expert.
They should just get them drunk. I mean, standing around peering over them and saying, come on then, is not going to work experience.
Didn't one of you write about the Swedish PhD student who spent a long time... Feeling George up.
This is worrying. She's become Swedish in your imagination.
I'm sorry.
She always becomes Swedish. She was Swiss. Yeah.
She always becomes
Swedish, because that's a nice stereotype.
It's nicer, isn't it?
Falling into that one.
Anyway, right. We're going to come back to Henry in a moment to discuss the urgent news about some tiger poo. In case you want to read all about pandas, you can get The Way of the Panda, The Curious History of China's Political Animal. It's out now, and it's just in time for Christmas. Isn't that right, Henry?
Yes.
But now for something completely, okay, well, a little bit different.
Science Weekly.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The UK's biggest private solar power plant is now up and running. An array of more than 1,000 panels have been installed on top of a cow shed in Somerset. In fact, it's at Pilton Farm, site of the world-famous Glastonbury Music Festival. The photovoltaic modules will generate enough electricity to power the equivalent of 40 homes every year. The Guardian's Steve Morris put his wellies on and went to meet the man behind the festival, Michael Evis.
We had to make a major statement, okay, because we use so much stuff up. Yeah, you know, we've got generators, we've got lorries, we've got trains, we've got cars, and all that kind of thing. You know what I mean? So the solar panel thing was the easiest thing to do. It made financial sense. So I went to Trader's Bank in Bristol, the wonderful people that actually lent me half a million without asking any questions. We just need you to sign this letter. So it's so easy to get half a million quid for this scheme. We're going to do more of this because it's so easy, you know, and no moving parts, you know, there's no labour, there's no wear and tear, and 25 years guarantee on the panels, so that'll see me through, won't it, because I'm 75. So come on, where's that take me? 90-something.
Lucy Brooking-Clark, a Green Initiatives Coordinator. You know, we have to constantly look at it and see how we can make the festival more sustainable, and there's so many ways in which we can do that, and we've got to keep raising the bar, because it has a very big reputation for being a green festival, but obviously you can look at many aspects of it which isn't very green at all.
Bill Egan, I'm Technical Manager of Power Products for Aggreko.
So you're the man that gets Glastonbury working power-wise?
Power-wise in terms of temporary power, yes.
How many generators do you have?
We brought on, I think, about 240 this year.
So you're not going to lose a job just now?
Not just now. I was trying to do the sums on how many square metres or even square kilometres we'd have to cover in solar cells before I was out of a job, but I think we'd end up losing an awful lot of campgrounds. But no, it's great. I mean, it's good stuff. It's impressive to see it working so well too, even when the weather's not, you know, we're well away from the height of summer. It's real numbers coming out of it, not sort of token gesture, which I think is nice.
Solar panels, and the next thing will be an anaerobic digester, and you know that generates a lot of gas and energy and heat.
Even the doubters, you know, my farm electrician who does all the wiring for the festival and everything, and he said, oh, I don't think this is going to be worth it. But yesterday morning, pouring a rain, not a trace of any sun or any daylight even, and we were getting 40 kilowatts. Very extraordinary.
There's a link to that story on our Facebook group. Join up and search for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Still ahead on this podcast, awards, Richard Holmes, and music from the world's biggest ever science experiment. Now, at this point, we'd normally stick in something about this week's news stories, but there's just a bit too much other stuff going on, so we're going to shorten this bit down to one very important story. And again, it refers to you, Henry. Tell us about tiger poo.
Well, there's a paper out in the Journal of Applied Ecology that shows that looking at poo, tiger poo, or paw prints, which are known as pug marks, which I didn't know, is quite a good way of monitoring tiger numbers.
So this is about how you work out how many animals there are in the wild if something is endangered or rare. Mm. How literally would you count it? You mentioned with pandas again earlier, yeah, that actually droppings are a good way of doing this.
Yeah, I mean, tigers are very similar in many ways, very cryptic species, nocturnal in the case of tigers, and very few of them left. It's kind of heartening that there's something. Humans, as species as sophisticated as ourselves, we still have no idea how many tigers or pandas there are out there. I find that kind of, I don't know, strangely heartening. So except it's completely understandable. You know, these are difficult things to monitor, and trying to get a handle on that number is very hard. Probably the best way is through camera traps, which are set out in the forest. And they've done that for quite a long time in India, but it is expensive and labour-intensive. And so this study that's just out shows that actually just counting poo and looking at paw prints is a very good correlate or proxy for those camera trap figures. So you can infer the number of tigers from these signs, and then you can see whether the population is going up and down. Of course, if you don't know those things, conservation is a meaningless concept. You have to know how many there are out there in order to sort of conserve anything. So this is kind of baseline, basic stuff. But it's rather interesting that still here we're struggling to even know something as basic as that.
You've skillfully skirted around the real issue as to why you wanted to talk about this story. I mean, it's all this conservation stuff's important and interesting and fits in with the narrative, but there's something else about the poo that you particularly liked.
Yes, it was in the press release, actually, and it was the lead author who described... Well, here he goes. He says, tiger feces are the size of a large beetroot and have a characteristic pungent musky odour. And fresh tiger feces are normally accompanied by urine sprays that smell like well-cooked basmati rice. So there are some extra things you didn't know about.
So if anyone ever offers you basmati rice with beetroot sort of curry, stay away, I say.
So I've just got this picture of these, you know, these really dedicated scientists out there, and they're wandering around looking for beetroots and smelling...
We're going to leave that there. Good. I think it's a good place to leave it. There's lots more news stories on our website, of course. They include one about a planet from another galaxy, why the ugliest animals are at greater risk of extinction, and how you can get involved in a major international project to predict extreme weather. Links to all those stories can be found on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, where you can also subscribe to this podcast so that every program gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. Throughout 2010, the Royal Society of London has been celebrating its 350th anniversary. In a sense, it's a celebration of science itself, Britain's senior scientific institution. Sir Isaac Newton, Edmund Halley, Robert Hooke, Thomas Hobbes, Christopher Wren, and even Samuel Pepys were amongst those to be given those three letters, FRS, Fellows of the Royal Society. But as the biographer and author of Age of Wonder, Richard Holmes, points out, throughout this year of celebrations, there's been one ghost at the feast: the historic absence of women scientists from the Society's ranks.
Although it was founded in 1660, women were not permitted by statute to become fellows of the Royal Society until 285 years later. In Victorian Britain, the very idea of women doing serious science was widely ridiculed, and even botany, with its naming of sexual parts, could be regarded as morally perilous. In 1860, Thomas Henry Huxley, FRS, famed of course as Darwin's bulldog, wrote privately to his friend the great geologist Charles Lyell, 5/6 of women will stop in the doll stage of evolution to be the stronghold of parsonism, the drag on civilization, the degradation of every important pursuit in which they mix themselves, intrigue in politics and friponne in science. Re-examination of the Royal Society archives, however, has thrown new and unexpected light on these lost women of science. It emerges that women had a far more fruitful relationship with the Society than has previously been supposed or even imagined. Clearly, they played a significant part in many team projects, working both as colleagues and as assistants, although hitherto only acknowledged in their family capacities as wives, sisters, or daughters. But more crucially, they pioneered new methods of scientific education, not only for children, but for young adults and general readers. They also played a vital part as translators, illustrators, and interpreters, and most particularly as scientific popularizers. The first woman to attend a meeting of the Royal Society was Margaret Cavendish, the Duchess of Newcastle, in May 1667. On this occasion, she witnessed several experiments of colours, lodestones, microscopes, and was full of admiration, although, according to Pepys, her dress was so antique and her deportment so unordinary that the fellows were made strangely uneasy. The first original paper that might be considered as part of a scientific research program conducted by a woman and published in the Royal Society's journal, Philosophical Transactions, concerned extraterrestrial phenomena. It was by Caroline Herschel in August 1786. Caroline's speciality was discovering new comets, of which she found no less than 8 at a time when fewer than 30 were known. Women tended to see the educational possibilities of science in a far broader context than their male colleagues. Jane Marcet published the first truly best-selling scientific popularizer for young people in 1806. Breezily entitled Conversations in Chemistry, in which the elements of that science are familiarly explained and illustrated by experiments, it sold as many books as the poetry of Lord Byron, who incidentally was also FRS. Born in 1780, Mary Somerville was the brilliant and charming Scottish wife of William Somerville, FRS. She described herself as intensely ambitious to excel in something, for I felt in my own breast that women were capable of taking a higher place in creation than that assigned to them in my early days, which was indeed very low. Later, she set out to write a completely original book, The Connection of the Physical Sciences, in 1834. In it, she surveyed the whole field of contemporary sciences, chemistry, astronomy, physics, and drew attention to the unity of their underlying principles and their methodology. Nothing like this had previously been attempted. As a result of a praising review of the book, the inclusive term scientist was first coined. Amazingly, the word had not existed before 1834.
Richard Holmes' sequel to The Age of Wonder is The Lost Women of Victorian Science, which shall be published soon. Let's cross to Studio 3 now, where I think producer Andy's getting ready to record something.
The same time we have for breakfast.
For breakfast, I had 3 Weetabixes, or Weetabix-I. I'm Alex Chung, and I work at the Institute of Physics, and I'm in charge of the Physics.org Web Awards. The aim of the awards really was to tell people about great physics sites that are online that they might not know about. And it's sites that are for a public audience, so not sites for physicists, but sites for anyone who might have a slight interest in physics and want to find out a bit more.
Okay, well, let's go through some of the categories. Might as well start with the first
one. So the winner for best blog was Ethan Siegel's blog, Starts With a Bang. Ethan's a theoretical physicist, but he covers all kinds of physics, so anything from why dinosaurs went extinct to dark matter. Or I think it stood out because it really is accessible, so it's not, you don't need to know maths and equations, and it's not intimidating, it's very just straightforward, fun, playful.
Well, let's go on to the President's Prize.
It's kind of for the misfits, so any site which didn't fall under any other categories, so we just had it as a catch-all for any interesting sites that might crop up. And the winner was Zooniverse, which is a really, really fantastic site where it has a number of projects. The most famous one is probably Galaxy Zoo. And the aim of Galaxy Zoo is to classify galaxies. You have kind of basic training in how to recognize different types. And then you go through them just clicking, saying what kind they are. And then they pull together all the data from all the people who take part. And they actually produce some real physics research which gets published. And yeah, it's really interesting.
Best online magazine
was PopSci. And that's the online version of the Popular Science magazine, which has been around for ages and ages in the US. It's quite techie, quite into its gadgets and that kind of thing, but also has some real physics and real science and interesting, often quite quirky, quite offbeat stuff.
Best Q&A site.
And the winner for this category was New Scientist's Last Word site. So it kind of stems from the popular back page of New Scientist, where people kind of send in their questions about weird things they've found in their garden, and other readers write in with their answers. So the idea is exactly the same, but obviously it happens a lot quicker because it's all online.
So let's go through
the winner for the best kids site was NASA's Kids Club. And that's a site which is really, really flashy, the kind of stuff that kids like, you know, it's all very videos and Buzz Lightyear and what have you. To be honest, the games aren't always very sciencey. I played one this morning, which was about putting things in a space shuttle that all began with the letter R and included rabbits and raccoons, which probably don't really belong in a spacecraft.
Then a little bit older, I guess, the best revision site
was S-Cool. And S-Cool is a really great site. It's really well organized. So you've got all your information by topic. You've got little tests so you can find out whether you actually learn anything at school. And lots of revision tips and just anything that you could need for A-level or GCSE revision.
Great. I think that's it. Brilliant. Okay.
Oh, I think there's one last category. It's best podcast.
And
the winner for this one is a little known podcast known as Science Weekly.
You know what? I'd completely forgotten about that.
Yeah, I'm afraid I haven't brought in a gold trophy to hand over, but...
Well, we don't want to talk about it too much, but you probably do want to say a few nice words from the judges or something like that, you know.
Yeah, well, we have some nice comments from the judges. Someone said, well, Tom Winty said, you are the gold standard of science podcasting. Another judge, Gareth Mitchell from the BBC, said, Science Weekly has the gravity of Nature or Scientific American married with the easy, chatty style of Radio 5 Live.
What do they know, eh? Okay, I mean, I'm probably going to edit all of this out, but you might just want to mention the People's Choice Award as well.
Okay, well, I do think you do deserve a big pat on the back because you won both the Judges Award and the People's Choice Award. You know, this Science Weekly podcast really stood out because it's got some real solid science in there, but it's a really fun, easy listen. So it's the kind of thing I can imagine listening to in the car or in the kitchen doing the washing up. And it's the kind of thing that anyone can dip into and take an interest in.
Well, I suppose I would thank everyone, the listeners, for voting for us for the People's Choice Award. Thank you very much. It's not going to be a long speech now. I've left my speech out in the office, actually, so I can't. But I remember a few phrases from it. When I was growing up, in Mr. Sell's physics class doing my A-levels, working with those diffraction gauzes, never in my wildest dreams did I imagine that one day I'd win an award for physics. It's like a Nobel for me. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh, and if you do want to find out any more about our winners, then visit physics.org for all the URLs.
Forget the Beatles finally appearing in iTunes. This is the biggest music news of the week.
And when black holes destroy the earth, I'll be in a meeting.
Just in time for Christmas, a double album has been recorded by physicists at the Large Hadron Collider. A smash hit from those particle smashers in Geneva. Released on the Neutralino Records label, named after a hypothetical particle, Resonance features a variety of musical styles from classical to heavy metal. The album features a wealth of new songs, including an original blues song about CERN from physicist Stephen Goldfarb's Canet's Blues Band.
We got the LHC running now, Atlas, you're my home.
An arrangement from the Collider Trio. And even classical piano pieces by the head of the Atlas experiment, Italian scientist Fabiola Gianotti. Even Einstein once said, if I was not a physicist, I'd probably be a musician.
If you had a mind like mine, then I could talk to you, then I could feel through you, then we could share.
It's set for release on December the 6th, marking 13.7 billion years to the day since the Big Bang.
Hi, this is Maggie Philbin, and you're listening to the natural successor to Tomorrow's World, the Guardian Science Weekly podcast, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
So that's it for another delightful, possibly award-winning podcast. Thanks to Henry Nichols, whose book The Way of the Panda is out now. Thanks also to Richard Holmes and Alex Chung. Thanks also to Steve Morris and Ian Sample.
I'm Chris French, Professor of Psychology at Goldsmiths, University of London. And in next week's podcast, we'll be looking at miscarriages of justice caused by the legal system's misunderstanding of memory. However, as my first grandchild is due any day now, I may not turn up. In which case, my colleague, Professor Tim Valentine, will just have to manage without me.
Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
Actually, we might need to change that now to guardian.co.uk/award-winning Science Weekly. I'll sort that out for next week.
Okay, whatever, Andy. Follow this podcast on Twitter, and we'll let you know every time a new podcast is born. Search for @scienceweekly. To be alerted to all of the Guardian Science content, though, follow @guardianscience. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. And listen how there's no outtakes this time. None.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
A smash hit from those particle... You know what it sounds to me like? It's like those Time Life adverts. It's a Time Life advert, isn't it? It's like sensual moods. Particle physics moods. A smash hit from those particles. Sorry. Oh, this is terrible. I'm going crazy. It's set for release on December the 6th, marking the 37th. That's really good. That's really good. I like that. What, because December the 6th is the birthday, this one.
Am I coming across okay? Because I don't get out much.
This is...
Yeah, no, totally. You come across far better than
you're
anyone
talking about,
else in this room.
You've come across... do you think... Is that me or you?
I had a bowl of sort of Jordan's Crunchy something.
There's a thing down...
Yeah, no, I can hear myself now.
I won't tell you what I had for breakfast, but I will tell you that while I was having it, I realised that my mobile phone was going around in my washing machine. Mm. And so I had to drain it out and take the phone out.
That is bad.
That's a better story.
I tried to find breakfast this morning, but the queues were too long down at the canteen thing, and I wanted some sort of egg thing in a sandwich. Maybe. Can you bring breakfast to this?
No.
Sports day, 5 meter winning, 5 meter badge, you know, swimming. Do you remember those?
I have a confession to make about my 5 meter badge. I can still remember it. I must have been about 7. My toe touched the floor, but I told the woman. Right, anyway.
Yeah, sounds boring.
We got the LEC running now, Atlas, your mile. The LEC's running now, Atlas, your mile. I've been working all night out at point one, looking for the Higgs, that son of a gun. The LEC's running now, Atlas, your mile. In the inner detector, we got all kinds of tracks. Yeah, in the inner detector, we got all kinds of tracks. You got an SCT and a TRT, that pixel detector won't let it be. You gotta have all them tracks if you want the facts. If you're looking for heat, we got the calorimetry. If you're looking for heat, we got the calorimetry. We got the liquid argon and the HEC, that tau gauss pump full of energy. Little energy in everything we see. We got the LHC running now, Atlas, you're my home. The LEC's running now, Atlas, you're my home. I've been working all night out at point one, supersymmetry, lots of fun. The LEC's running now, Atlas, you're my home. Play it for me now, play it. Well, the muon spectrometer, everything's going just fine. In the muon spectrometer, everything's going just fine. We got an MDT and an IPC, a TGC and a CSC. Everything'll be just fine if we stay in line. We're surrounded by the greatest magnets you'll ever see. Surrounded by the greatest magnets you'll ever see. We got a solenoid and three toroids. Those muons are getting paranoid. No matter how fast they go, they just can't get free. We got the LHC running now, Atlas, you're my home. The LHC's running now, Atlas, you're my home. We're We got the LHC running now, Atlas, you're my home. LHC running now, Atlas, you're my home. Well, our friends at 2 and 5 and 8, they might find the Higgs, they're gonna be too late. The LHC running now, Atlas, you're my home. Yes, our friends at 2 and 5 and 8, they might find the Higgs, they're gonna be too late. The LHC running now, Atlas, you're my home.
I was completely confused. That's made up, isn't it?
No.
What did you do to the horse?
It's a Gymkhana.
What?
Yeah. I joined the Horse Riding Society as a bet because it was called Leather and Whip Society in Freshers Week. And I joined. I said, I bet you won't join this. Bet you will. I went, I joined, stayed in it for a few years, and I won an award for a Gymkhana.
That's unbelievable. That's how far you've come from a panel beater's son. You know? it's
stereotype. What is this stereotype? The Swedish woman, because Swedish women. I'm only anyway, swearing a lot, so we don't put this in, Andy. I'm.
There's no way you think that he's not going to use that. I mean, God. Seriously.
What's that Swedish stereotype?
You're one of those myth
stereotype that says that.
Anyway.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.